Hello and welcome to The Urbanist, Monaco's program all about the built environment. I'm your host, Carlotta Ribello. Coming up, we bring you a series of conversations from the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum, taking place in Dubai this week. We will hear from the man behind some of the world's tallest buildings, Gordon Gill, discuss the existential threats facing island nations with Angela Servina, the CEO of the Seychelles Planning Authority, speak with architect Daniel Munoz from AGI Madrid about international collaboration, and sit down with Helle Suholt from human-centric urban designers, GEL. All that coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Carlotta Ribello. Earlier this week, the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum took place in Dubai, bringing together more than 500 top thinkers and doers in sustainable urban development. The focus was on how the Global South can tackle heat resilience, climate mitigation and adaptation. The Urbanist's own Andrew Tuck was there moderating some of the discussions happening at the forum, and Monaco's Tom Edwards was also on the ground capturing a series of conversations with some of the star speakers. One of them was the architect Gordon Gill, whose portfolio includes the world's first net-zero energy skyscraper and the world's first large-scale positive energy building. Tom caught up with Gordon after his panel, and he began by delving into one of the topics he spoke about on stage, the idea of zero compromise when it comes to the pursuit of architectural perfection.
I think we have to be very careful about what we think perfect means. I'm concerned mostly about the notion that we have to give up or alter cultures in order to solve problems. And I think the work that we're trying to do is to understand people's needs and solve problems for them. And in that way, hopefully you have a much more long-lasting legacy around the solution than you do if you simply impose a preconception. The work is not aesthetically driven. I hate to tell you that, but it's true. We do pursue what we hope will be beautiful work, but that's not where it starts. It starts with a kind of deeper analysis or trying to understand the environmental, social, political issues, all the cultural aspects of where we are working and what is needed. The aesthetics will come from that.
If we talk about establishing that context for these different projects, and obviously you've worked throughout your career, and obviously currently so many very high profile projects in so many very contrasting markets. Talk to me about the process of establishing that context. Obviously it's a guess about deep research, but there is this humanity that's woven into it. What does that actual process look like for you?
It's a fun process. It's not indifferent or analytical in terms of data. It's everything from going into a place and having that roadside food, going to people's homes and chatting to them, meeting their children and their family, and understanding what this place is all about. And, you know, we'll go for walks, we'll do our academic research, but at the end of the day, we want to understand the human aspects of that city or that village or that town or that country. Once we understand that and we go back and ask questions, what we don't do is say, we know what you need. We say, here's what we're thinking. Does this make sense to you? And if the answer is no, we keep trying. So we're not indifferent to changing ideas. The process is fluid. It's organic. We like as much input as we could possibly get. There's always a time constraint. Always. And so we try to do as much of that up front as possible. And if we can do it even before we kind of quote-unquote start the project, we will. We're lucky in some cases, because if we've been to the region for 20 years, it's a little easier to start. If it's the first time we're going in, then it's a little harder to do. But we do our best to try and do that.
Another reflection that you made in the panel, I think, well, you and the colleagues there were kicking it around, was this question about passive and technical fixes, which I think is a really interesting area. Tell me a little bit about that. Well, presumably there is clearly a tension there, or is there an opportunity implicit in that dynamism of those two things? Are they in conflict? Do they work together?
Yeah. No, they're not in conflict at all. You know, look, when we talk about sustainable design today, a lot of people talk about it as if it's something new. It's not, you know. Indigenous architecture was extremely sustainable. It had to be. I argue that as designers and architects, we have unlearned the very principles that gave kind of traditional architecture its strength. Cross ventilation, you know, simple things like comfort, protection, the notion of how the sun moves across the surfaces of materials or the distance in between buildings in order to provide shade. We unlearned these processes because we relied on technical or technology, air conditioning, elevatoring, all the fun stuff that we use to densify our cities, but we unfortunately abandoned basic passive principles in lieu of technological solutions. We think that's an error. So we try, first of all, to put the project in a position of very strong passive design solutions. In that way, we find that often the projects need less by nature of their orientation or their design. They need less to perform. And so the energy consumption required to push that building to whether it's net zero or net zero carbon is less than if you ignored it. At that point, you have to decide what is the role of technology in this space. Is it to enhance those attributes? Is it to overpower them? We don't like that. We like the technology to be almost invisible. We don't want it to be on display necessarily, and we don't see it as a tour de force. Sometimes we're asked to express it as part of the language of that building because the client wants people to know that's what it's about. But often from a pedestrian environment, landscape is much richer and much more important to us than is a photovoltaic array. And we use landscape and natural features a lot in our architecture to kind of aid comfort, aid the psychology behind comfort. And that's a process that we think has been successful so far.
Can I ask you a Chicago question?
Yeah.
Great town, Chicago. One of my favorites. And obviously people kind of know it as the home of the skyscraper or whatever. Yeah. And obviously so much of your personal kind of architectural heritage and DNA or whatever is formulated in that town. Does that inform your practice still, do you think? I mean, we're talking about a sense of place and belonging. Yeah, and just and that heritage there, because you talk about making sure that these projects are obviously context specific and human centric, yeah. But there is that in your experience and in the expression of your ideas, right?
Yeah. No, Chicago and the experiences in Chicago have been extremely influential on the way that we work. Chicago is a very well planned city. And so we start with urban design, even when we're doing a super tall. And the notion of open space, I think Chicago has 35% public open space on the lakefront. The most valuable land in Chicago is given to the people on the lakefront. It's not occupied by buildings, which has confounded many a developer over the years. But nonetheless, let's transfer that idea to Owosso, where instead of putting the building as the center stage, as the focal point of the object, we actually created the public space as the focal point of the development. These lessons are run deep in our DNA, I think. The super tall work and the building work that we have done over the years, I think, has helped us understand technology and understand the tectonics of buildings. But at the end of the day, we have to resolve that in a very kind of humanistic way. So all our buildings are really talking about how we can protect or shed wind for the pedestrian, how we can meet the ground gracefully and actually have accessibility, not just physically, but psychological accessibility to the building. What is the role of this project? If we're doing something like a high rise at the kind of apex of the skyline, in the middle, at the base, what are we doing with these relationships to our neighbors and vice versa? We're often looking at the impacts of what we do on our neighbors, because these buildings and these projects that we do have footprints and impacts that leave, you know, results. So we need to understand those, and we model scenarios around context all the time, whether it's ours or somebody else's.
My thanks there to Gordon Gill in conversation with Tom Edwards. Next up, we heard from Helle Suholt, one of the founding partners of the urban design specialists GEL. We spoke to Helle back in 2022 about human-scale design, a topic that GEL specializes in, but we wanted to find out more about how thinking on the right scale can help us to build more sustainable urban environments. Tom began by asking Helle about whether she thinks there is a tendency to think too large when it comes to these important urban conversations.
There is so much lingo in these types of settings, for lack of a better word. But by that I mean there is a misunderstanding that just by delivering climate-friendly, high-quality architecture, that it automatically becomes people-centric at the same time. And I think that is a misinterpretation. We need to be incredibly intentional if we want to make cities inclusive for people. And that both is within the design itself of spaces and buildings and neighborhoods, but particularly also our processes for people to really trust and engage and, at the end of the day, fill the whole city with life.
Well, that's another thing that really jumped out at me in your remarks. You talked about the everyday, and I know at Gale there's a big focus on eye level, whether that's kids' eye level, older people, senior citizens. How important is it, again, to factor in that quotidian detail? I guess because it's mundane, right? It's not so sexy to talk about on a planning basis, but that everyday engagement is what makes the city. And again, we omit that, I guess, at our peril if we don't incorporate that robustly.
The everyday life is what takes up most space in cities. And we know it as tourists and visitors to other places. We go to the neighborhoods that has the most authentic, natural sort of everyday life of people living and working there already. So that's really what we need to cater for and understand what is unique about this particular community that we are engaging. And of course, we come with our international methodology, where we have developed a way of tracking what kind of activities are taking place in a space, how do people move around, who are present at what times, and so forth. But we always try to, on top of that, you could say, universal aspect of everyday life that brings us all together as human beings, we always look for those cultural nodes and a deeper understanding of what is particular in terms of identity and culture for every place.
Now, there were some good discussions about the tools that are at our collective disposal to address some of these challenges. And again, a theme actually that's run through this whole conference is about the potential threat of tech. It's disruptive, AI, how does that reshape the landscape? Are you still broadly sort of technophilic and confident that these tools are net positives? They benefit us, they facilitate change at a greater pace and so forth. Or do you understand people who are more reticent, reluctant, frankly, a little nervous about their impact? Is there a willful misunderstanding about what the intention is with this technology?
Yeah, it's a balance. There's definitely a lot of threats related to technology, no doubt. But I also think we need the technology because there are so many challenges. We can't just have traditional old-fashioned public hearing meetings and expect people to turn up. If we really want to understand the everyday life and we want to listen to the unheard voices, we need technology to engage people in so many different ways so that we can really understand what life is like from an eye level. And we can use social media, we can use all kinds of apps to do that. And by gathering new types of data sets, we can overlay that with transport data or other information and thereby know much more. I also think that with the challenges that we have today with lack of equity, climate action needed, we are looking into increasingly complex issues that we need to deal with. And some solution for climate might actually make it worse for people and vice versa. So I think we can look at technology as a tool to help us deal with these complex issues. And then it's still a human task to find the right balance. A woman on my panel was saying that ultimately, in order to engage, you have to have trust. I think trust is diminishing in our societies. I think populations in cities are becoming more and more polarized. So the most important role, I guess, for public space and for these digital tools to help us with the engagement is actually to allow for empathy with others. It's to ensure that people have visual eye contact and proximity with others and people that are different from themselves, so that they can have empathy for other ways of working and living.
Well, it's interesting, and it strikes me that your work as one of these sort of advocates for and defenders almost of the sort of public realm or whatever you want to call it, you end up wearing this sort of, you're a sort of an ambassador for that thinking. It's a diplomatic role. You're talking about having to almost kind of lobby people, the public opinion. Are you okay with that? Is that the job of, because it's funny, we know a few people obviously in Gale, they're such a fun group and they wear that responsibility. It always seems to me quite lightly, but it must weigh heavy at times. Is that your job? You know, there should be other stakeholders who should be carrying that burden. No, or are you kind of okay? Are you sanguine about it?
Well, someone has to do it, right? You're absolutely right. I think part of being someone from Gale, you almost feel that it's part of your toolbox, but it's also an obligation, which is maybe something that brings everybody on the team together, something that we share and work for and strive for in all of our projects. Are we successful in every project? No, not always, because it is a political space and there are different forces at play. But I'm still a huge believer in public space having to be there in order to really support engagement and inclusiveness in cities. I can't really see a city being engaging without it.
Well, to that point then, we mentioned the team and this positive orientation. It feels always very optimistic, the discourse, the projects. Maybe pick one out, a current thing or something that's just coming together within the Gale universe that's one that embodies a lot of these values. Maybe that you're just most excited about. You know, there must be different projects where you're like, I'm happy to spend a bit of extra time on this one. Is there? And it's probably a few, but maybe pick one out for us.
Well, I think at Gale, it's a combination of, we have some really important flagship projects that can really show the way and be inspirational for a lot of other projects. I think it's fantastic to see how the Shanghai waterfront has developed. And we started out in 2017, I think, and already now we have more than 40 kilometers of walkable, pedestrianized space along the riverfront. And it is amazing to see the Chinese life unfold, and everything from dogs running skateboards to children doing all kinds of plays. And that's maybe, I would say, sort of a flagship project, and it's being inspirational for other cities in China and Asia. But here in the Gulf region, we are currently working with the early childhood authorities in Abu Dhabi, and that's a much more everyday life type of work, because we are really looking into how children can have access to playgrounds and outdoor community places, spaces that are maybe close to childcare or schools, community centers, really in order to support early childhood development, to prevent what we are unfortunately seeing already now with more children being obese, more children getting asthma, getting diabetes at a very early age, simply because they grow up being indoors in air-conditioned environments most of their time, and with a nanny culture as well, not necessarily connecting with other kids in the neighborhood where they grow up. So again, we try to use parks and playgrounds and play equipment and the outdoors of public spaces to see whether we can actually connect children to one another in the neighborhoods where they live.
Hello, Sue Holt there with Tom Edwards, and my thanks to them both. AGI Architects are an international firm with offices in Kuwait and Spain. The 40-strong team collaborates internationally to find architectural solutions through distinctive and imaginative design. Tom caught up with the managing director of AGI's Spanish office, Daniel Muñoz, and he began by asking him about the challenge designers face tackling projects that have hugely varied contexts but largely similar goals.
I think we were talking about the social media that tried to be global social media where everyone needs the same things and everyone wants the same things, but the reality and identity and how they live their lives, nothing to do with it. So maybe if you talk about Emirati or Kuwaiti, when they go to the States, they live in a way. When they stay at home, they live in another way. We were talking about Matchless, for example. This is an amazing concept that for Europeans is crazy. You open your house once a week and whoever comes in and you show your generosity and you talk about topics, general topics or issues that are surrounding you that maybe on that small community you can have a help. So you have to understand or this cultural way of living.
Maybe pick out a specific project for us. You choose the geography. I don't know where Saudi is. You're here in the United Arab Emirates. And tell me how that embodies exactly what we've described, the challenge and then the delivery and then the kind of realization of it. Is there something that you tend to go to as a great exemplar?
For example, I think we could talk about two different projects. We have one last project we're making in Spain. It's an elderly residence. And for example, we had to accommodate to an environment that it's quite cold and snowy, but also it has to be with all the hospital regulations, but not a hospital look. Mm-hmm. And you also have to take into account that all these people who are coming to this hospitality residential, they are coming from really small villages around the place. They are usually adapted to a really small group of people. So you have to make them feel home. There is a new concept on how you develop these residences and how they need to be connected to the place they are and how to be connected to the nature. Because these people, before they come here, they are working on their land. They are producing their tomatoes, producing their things, and now you cannot put them into a kind of hospital where they cannot do anything. So this is one of them. And we took, for reference, like terracotta roofings. They are historical on the area. And we have a lot of public space with existing trees that we leave there, that they produce nuts. So this is one of them. And for example, there's another example we did in Kuwait that it's called Three Gardens. It's a house that we developed because they wanted to live in the house and they wanted to live outside the house during the whole year. So we developed different levels and layers of courtyards from basement to rooftop so they could use it during the different months of the year and periods of the day. So these are different approaches to what they need.
I like that kind of seasonality. It's really interesting. And there's some honorary construction going on in the background. Our listeners might hear as well. Talk to me about this idea of belonging, because this is a conversation we had yesterday. We were talking about placemaking, but we said so much of it boils down to this feeling of belonging. And you've described even on those projects, it's so important that the actual end user, it's not really about the practitioners as technically accomplished as they are. It's about the feeling. It's an emotion for the dweller or whatever you want to call it. How do you, I don't know, how do you factor that concept of belonging somewhere into your work?
It's quite difficult. I think you need to get in touch with your clients and they need. That's what I was talking in a big picture with cities, that we have all the data of the citizens on Meta or Facebook or whatever, and that cities needs to be aware of what the citizens need in a great scale, AI, whatever. No? But when you talk to a private client and their family, you need to get in touch and involved with them. And even I can say we met one of the clients. Site construction is crazy for all clients, and they want to quit every time you start a site, and everyone who did something at home, you know it. And I remember we were visiting the house, almost completed, and I talked to the client, and the client said, I want to sell the house. I don't want this house anymore. I want to sell it. And I told him, give the house a year, because we think we did a great job, and you will live in the house incredibly. And this client came back to us this year for another house. So
that's belonging.
That's
right?
Belonging.
That's belonging. Yeah. Daniel, just tell me, we kind of wrap up a lot of the sessions talking about a call to action, because I think a lot of these narratives, they kind of, well, hopefully inspire people a little bit. What about a bit of a provocation? If you wanted to sort of give people a bit of a prod and inspire them to think differently about what kind of thought process go into building these better neighborhoods, projects that are truly fit for purpose, what would you kind of nudge people
about? I think we need to talk to each other in the proximity. We are involved on lots of information, generalistic information that comes to us and give us a sensibility to certain themes, for example, security. I don't find any issue in security, and everybody in Spain or lots of brands are selling security systems. There's no issue with security, but you feel like... So if you go in your community and you talk about what are your concerns and you find that in common, you really have them, then we need to find a way that these ideas goes to the rulers and we put more experimental urbanistic design in certain places. It's okay, we need to plan a city for 20 or 30 years, but we can experiment in certain parts of the city when we detect there is a problem. It's not that, okay, if it would be a body or a human being, okay, we will die of a heart attack, cancer, whatever. But if we break a leg, we heal it. So why don't we work in parts in the city and not that much on the big picture?
Daniel Munoz there in conversation with Tom Edwards. And finally today, we head to the Seychelles. Island nations face one of the most immediate existential threats from climate change, with sea level rise literally eroding the very land on which they sit on. Tom Edwards caught up with Angela Servina, the CEO of the Seychelles Planning Authority, to discuss the role that islands have in the global fight against climate change. And he began by asking about the Seychelles' dual needs to support the tourism industry and to discourage the carbon emissions caused by international travel.
It's actually quite challenging for us because, you know, we are already protecting around 80% of our land and sea mass. So the rest that remains, we have our own people to think of development for our own country, and then we have the need to preserve for the tourists. More and more tourists want to come to Seychelles, obviously, but on our side, we need to strike the perfect balance between how much we can welcome and other resources for our own people and the preservation of our environment, of course. This is a primary objective for us because this is the only resource that we have. We don't have any other tangible natural resources that we can exploit, so we have to be careful in how we exploit our beauty, our natural environment. This is our gold for us. This is our oil, so we have to be extremely careful. And it's very difficult because the terrain, our country is mostly mountainous, so we have to be careful when we consider, when we approve development applications, because we have to ensure that these marry very well or are in sympathy with the topography, the natural environment. It always comes down to protecting what we have at the end of the day. We are open, we want to have the business, we want to have tourists, but at the same time, we have this thin line that we cannot cross.
And just tell me, how important are these kinds of forums? Because we get stakeholders from multidisciplinary backgrounds, different geographies, different perspectives. Presumably, that is the kind of moment where you can galvanize genuine action and actually really move the needle. These must be fundamentally important to have this kind of conversation.
It's always important when we get these exposures because then we can make our plight heard. What has been interesting about this one here is that most of the countries here, they face some kind of similar challenges that we do. It may not be exactly the same, but all of us that have come here, we have some of the same issues that we are trying to resolve for our people. So the networking has been extraordinary. I've been able to meet, discuss and talk and get in touch with so many people, so many opportunities. My colleague from the Seychelles Investment Board, I put her in touch with so many people, so many ideas and innovations that we can bring in and discuss and take a look at. So these are actually very important for us. In fact, I think this is one of a kind for the Expo City, even for the region, because what I'm seeing here is the will to be the platform for get the connection or get in contact with this or that. So this is extraordinary.
Are you optimistic then? I said I sort of described the challenge you face. It's scary, I guess, right? And it's a huge challenge. No one can do it on their own. I guess you have to stay optimistic, but are you optimistic that we can get enough of the stakeholders moving in the right direction?
Well, by nature, I am always an optimistic person. So I look for the best or hope and wish for the best and pray for the best. So yes, I am optimistic. I believe that where there's the willpower, the political will, which I know my country has, we will be able to do it. So, yeah, I am.
Angela Servina speaking with Tom Edwards there, and my thanks to them. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. You can subscribe on all good podcast platforms to get new episodes of the show every week. And you can subscribe to Monocle Magazine too for regular reports on all things architecture and urbanism. Just head over to monocle.com. The Urbanist is produced by me, Carlotta Ribello, and by David Stevens. And today's episode was also produced by our team on the ground in Dubai, Sam Impey and Tom Edwards. Andrew Tuck will be back next week. I'm Carlotta Ribello. Goodbye, and thank you for listening, City Lovers.